Science thrives where there is wonder and mystery. It seeks to describe everything around us, from vast cosmic events to the intricate dance of our smallest atoms. The Cleveland Museum of Natural History has a curated collection which bears testimony to these epic wonders and stories. Join me, Josh Avsek, as we search for answers alongside the scientists who call our museum home. All this and more in the Cleveland Podcast of Natural History. It's an absolute honor to have you all on my very first episode of the Cleveland Podcast of Natural History. Today, we have a group of incredible astronomers, Monica Marshall, Destiny Thomas.
Hi, everybody.
And Nick Anderson.
Thanks for having us.
All right, let's dive right in. Monica, can you explain what sort of cosmic events cause an eclipse to happen?
Eclipses happen when one astronomical body moves in front of another one and it blocks out some of that light. And if you're standing in the shadow of that body, then you'll be witnessing the moon completely obscuring the solar disk of the sun. The sun, the moon, and the earth will be all aligned.
Now, essentially, the moon is much, much smaller than the sun. The sun's about 400 times bigger than the moon. But coincidentally, the sun is also about 400 times farther away from Earth. And so that's what we're talking about here with the beautiful cosmic coincidence of the moon eclipsing the sun.
Okay, so that's how an eclipse works. It's basically when the moon or the Earth are casting a shadow on one another.
There's two major categories of eclipses. So those would be solar and lunar. Within the solar group, there are partial solar eclipses, total solar eclipses, and then this other type called an annular solar eclipse.
So this is a total solar eclipse.
Exactly.
Total solar eclipses, they're very special because we live in this point in time where the moon and the sun, their apparent size looks similar to us on the ground here on the Earth. So long ago, the moon was closer to the Earth, and actually the moon is slightly moving slowly away from the Earth, about 1.5 inches per year.
This concept of how lucky we are, this is a really cool concept.
I hope we stay lucky. Now, if it's overcast, like very, very cloudy, we won't see that glow of the corona, but it will still get dark enough, even with the clouds, that you'll notice something is still going on. But we're hoping clear skies and a not so cold day.
The nice thing is that if you actually look at like past April 8th, take a look at the historical data, then Cleveland at least fares a little bit better than some of the other major cities in the Midwest that are located within the path of totality.
So the path of totality, that is going to be the area where the sun is completely covered. Is that something that any of you as astronomers here at the museum have gotten to experience?
I was one of the fortunate few that was able to see the total solar eclipse back in 2017. So at that time, I was a new member on the astronomy department here at the museum, and we led a trip for museum members down to southern Kentucky. We ended up in an old drive-in theater. So it was a neat venue to see the event, and it was something that I'll never forget. I mean, nothing compares to totality itself, but it's really strange. It's like you're outside on this gloomy, overcast day, and the colors are real washed out. So the landscape takes on this silvery, metallic, grayish blue hue, but you also have bright sunlight still. It is this weird kind of flinty appearance to everything. Yet on top of that, the fact that you'll have the sharpest shadows you could ever imagine. And I think for me, that was where the anticipation was really building. And then comes totality. And in 2017, it was about 2.5 minutes of twilight in the middle of the afternoon. And it's unreal. The sky darkens to like a deep twilight. It's not like midnight, but it is like this deep, dark twilight. In fact, it gets so dark that the bright stars and planets become visible in the middle of the day. And that's overhead. But around the horizon, near the ground, you'll get 360 degrees of sunset, which is absolutely gorgeous. But nothing compares to looking straight up at the sun and moon at that time. It really did seem like this weird portal to another dimension. I think you have the moon on one hand, which is this jet black hole up in the sky, but then around it, you get this delicate, wispy glow, and it's the outermost part of the sun, what we call the corona, and it has all these lovely streamers and loops, and it's a feast for the eyes. But it's not just the eyes. I mean, you're going to have the temperature drop. You know, there was a chill in the air. It was late August, and your hair is standing up on your arms. The wind, sometimes it picks up or dies down, but it often changes direction. There's a lot of really, really strange things that happen.
What I'm most excited about are those few minutes during twilight when all of the animals kind of shift. All the nocturnal animals, they wake up, and then all the daytime animals, they go to sleep. Did you get to experience anything like that?
It's funny. I didn't really have too many little critters or creatures around, but I got definitely my fair share of interesting human reactions. I think I was one of the people that just froze. I mean, I was like a statue. I couldn't speak. I was just in awe at everything happening around me. It's just surreal.
I know for me personally, in 2017, I didn't get a chance to go to the Path of Totality. I only saw an 80% partial eclipse, which we had here in Cleveland. For us this time, we're pretty fortunate in Ohio and in Cleveland because we're actually pretty close to the center line of the Path of Totality as well. So I think it's fantastic. We went from seeing a partial eclipse to getting the best seats for Totality this time around.
Yeah, so the Path of Totality this time around is going to be about 115 miles wide. And really what that path is it's the path of the moon's dark central shadow sweeping across Earth's surface. And one of the things I'd love to see, if you time it right and you look to the west just before the onset of totality, you can spot the moon's shadow barreling towards you like this onrushing tidal wave. And it's a little more dramatic, I think, if you get to, you know, like an elevated viewing site, like way up on a mountaintop somewhere. Get to see features way off in the distance, you know, entering into that shadow before you yourself are engulfed.
Now, anywhere outside of that path of totality, that was what Nick was describing as the partial eclipse. Is that correct?
A partial solar eclipse. It's interesting, but a total solar eclipse is life-changing. And the difference there truly is day and night. On average, we get between 2 and 5 solar eclipses per year on a global scale. What's really rare is having a total solar eclipse visible from your own backyard. So that only occurs on average about once every 375 years.
Oh, what?
Yeah, so total solar eclipses happen on Earth on average about once every 18 months. So if you have the time and the means to do it, you can travel the world in search of eclipses. But we haven't had one here in the U.S. since 2017. I think a lot of people will remember that event.
And I assume then many of the eclipses are simply going over the ocean?
It's when you gotta hop aboard a cruise.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, when was the last time anybody here in Cleveland got to experience a total eclipse?
One of the last ones from Ohio, Josh, was back in the 1800s, 1806. Actually.
In 1806, so we're talking our great-grandparents haven't even gotten a chance to see what we are about to experience. Is it cyclical? Like, do we already know when the next solar eclipse in Ohio is going to be?
For the next one in Ohio after this April 8th, that'll be 2099, but for Cleveland specifically, which is where we are, that'll be 2444.
So
that's a long time to wait for the next one.
That's, wow, okay. To really put this in perspective, everybody, sounds like you have to be in the path of totality. To be in Cleveland to experience this, you had to be around in 1806. But now, after we experience this eclipse, nobody in our family line will be able to experience this until 2444 here in Cleveland. So that's pretty amazing. Monica and Destiny, I was hoping to ask you a little bit about your background here in astronomy. If I remember correctly, you went to the same high school.
You know what's funny? We actually had the same high school astronomy teacher, which we both went to Euclid High School. Shout out to Euclid High School.
What's the teacher's name?
Matthew Young. So
Mr. Young.
Same thing for you, Destiny, right?
Yeah. Mr. Young, Matthew Young. I got to get used to calling him Matthew Young. Not that I graduated high school, but.
Me too.
Yes. Matthew Young, amazing teacher. Very supportive, just like Monica mentioned. And he also got me an internship here. Monica did hers 2 years prior to me. We went to the same high school. We were 2 years apart. Didn't realize that till we started working here together. last year, which is pretty spectacular. Then I went to Emory University. I'm not a fan of winter, so Atlanta was very popular in my list of schools.
Yeah, I thought that was also really cool because we both had the same internship during high school. And then we both left Cleveland and we both went to different states, but on opposite directions.
Yeah, you went where it's cold in Alaska. Yeah, I went where it's hot.
Yeah, in Atlanta. So very different. But then we ended up coming, both of us ended up coming back to Cleveland after our college careers. And we ended up landing in the same spot, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it comes full circle.
Now, Nick, tell me a little bit about, of course, how you became an astronomer. And also, what does your job entail?
Really, the first thing that sparked my interest in astronomy was watching meteor showers with my family as a kid. So there's a great meteor shower that happens on an annual basis every year in August called the Perseids. So I have some really fond memories of viewing the Perseids with my family. Never really thought astronomy was going to be something I would pursue as a career. I started out actually studying business in college and then made stars my business. So I was going to Bowling Green State University at the time. I had a great mentor there, took me under his wing. And really what I latched onto was the outreach aspect, working in the planetarium, up in the observatory, bringing groups up. Just worked out that found a planetarium opening here in the Cleveland area right after graduation. Been over a decade now in the planetarium world. And here at the museum, the astronomy team, that's really what we focus on, is sharing the wonders of the universe with the public. The really cool thing about that is, you know, we have a lot of freedom to explore and be creative here. We deliver all of our programming live. So we do a lot of public shows, but we also get countless school groups coming through for field trips. We go out into the community and do outreach. It's getting out there and interacting with the public.
Maybe my favorite part is just storytelling. I feel like someone who loves their job, they love to tell the story of it.
To tell the story of the stars is very interesting to me. So like to tell the stories of the different star patterns in the sky, the constellations, and how this culture thought of seeing the stars this certain way to this culture saw it as something different. And you see that in different cultures looking up at a total solar eclipse. A lot of cultures, they share commonality in what they thought was happening to the sun during a total solar eclipse. Like, for example, a lot of people know a lot about Greek mythology. Actually, the word eclipse comes from the root word from the Greeks, meaning abandon. But the Greeks, they thought that when a total solar eclipse happened in the sky in totality, was a bad omen. Something bad was supposed to happen to the people on the earth. The only way to bring back the sun was to please the god in some way. So maybe a ritual or a sacrifice would go on. And you see that through all different cultures, but in slightly a different way.
First thing to that is that should you think that you sacrificing or doing something would reveal that sun, it would. In 4 minutes, that sun is going to reveal itself.
Yeah,
so you are always going to think that, sacrificing that goat was definitely the smart thing because it worked.
And even as we got better with learning about eclipses, tracking the sun, tracking the moon, tracking when an eclipse would happen and recording this, a lot of cultures, even if they understood, they still believed a lot of bad things would occur for a very long time. Still to this day, we might still think the end of the world is happening. So it's interesting.
Right. That feeling of something odd is happening still resonates.
Knowing it's coming and knowing the reasoning behind it are two totally different things. And I guarantee you there are still cultures out there who are assigned some meaning that maybe it is a little bit of a negative thing that's about to happen. Rewinding just a little bit, going back in time, can anyone speak on what is known as the Battle of the Eclipse?
That was a battle that took place in the year 585 BCE between the Lydians and the Medes. And it's thought that this battle was taking place during a total solar eclipse, and that caused the fighting to cease. Totality arrived, and they had a truce because... Now, hey, this is a sign that maybe what we're doing right now isn't what we should be doing. There's actually some claims that that was the first predicted solar eclipse in 585 BC by someone named Tales. I think that's...
I like this idea. This in all the other moments of history, it's like a bad omen. But in this one, they actually stopped hurting each other. Can you remind me, what should we expect for totality?
Yeah, for us on April 8th, we're going to have totality in Cleveland for about 3 minutes and 49 seconds. One of the longest times in Ohio, actually.
Oh, so that's a really long time. That's awesome.
Yeah, so The eclipse itself lasts for a couple of hours, but totality, well, it's a very fleeting moment. But for us in Cleveland, most of the day will be pretty normalized up until about 2 p.m. That's when things start to get pretty interesting. The moon makes first contact with the solar disk of the sun.
First contact is around 2 p.m., like Monica mentioned. So there's four points of contact. And then once you get to second contact, that is totality. So this is the stages where the moon is slowly covering up the solar disk. So right before second contact, right before we get to totality, we get something called the diamond ring effect. It's almost like seeing a ring up in the sky. So we get a big flash of the sun's light that's sneaking past the moon. And that big flash of light is like the diamond. And then the loop that would essentially go through your finger, that's going to be the sun's upper atmosphere. So that would be the corona. That's another spectacular thing you get to see during the total solar eclipse. You get to see those upper layers of the sun's atmosphere.
Does the other points of contact have their own little like special thing?
They do. So it's like with second contact, you have a diamond ring effect. Then you hit totality. And then as totality is ending, you get another occurrence of the diamond ring effect where the sun's light starts to sneak right back past the moon as it slowly uncovers.
But the light would be on the opposite end, right? So the ring would be on the opposite. Okay.
Yep.
That's funny.
And they call it the diamond ring because you get this like stunning flash of light on one side. Let's say for like the first diamond ring, the one right at the onset of totality, you know, you get that bright flash on one edge. And then on the opposite edge, you get the corona starting to emerge. So there's this wispy, soft white glow.
And then at around 3:13, that's when you'll see something known as Bailey's beads.
Bailey's beads.
The diamond ring is basically the final one of these, what we call Bailey's beads. And the moon's surface is not smooth. You know, it's rough and rugged. It's been battered by countless asteroids and comets smashing into its surface. So it's heavily cratered. It's got mountains and valleys. And so just before totality, you'll get sunlight passing through all the peaks and valleys along the edge of the moon. They're really described in detail by a guy by the name of Francis Bailey.
With every generation, eclipses have been able to reveal some really important truths about the universe. By observing an eclipse, for instance, we were able to prove a theory proposed by Einstein many years before. Nick, do you think you could tell us a little bit about that historic moment?
This was a total solar eclipse that was observed actually multiple locations. This group of scientists split up into two different groups. One headed off to Brazil, the other one to Principe, an island off the western coast of Africa. And the interesting thing there is that during totality, the sky darkened significantly. And so this was an opportunity for these scientists to observe a particular group of stars that were near the sun and moon during those few minutes. It was a group of stars in one of my personal favorite constellations, Taurus the Bull. So it's this little pointed V outline. It's a cluster of stars known as the Hyades. And Einstein's theory predicted that because of the immense gravity of the sun curving and warping the space around it, this should bend the light from those distant stars. And so the positions of these stars should be off slightly. The observations that they made that day matched up perfectly with what was predicted by Einstein's theory.
That is, it's like too good to be true. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, one of my favorite discoveries. Way back in the 1860s, the study of light was becoming very popular. We call it spectroscopy, where you can take the spectrum of something and you can understand what it's made of. You can understand the elements that make up that object. People in the 1860s, they were witnessing total solar eclipses. And at the time, during totality, you can see these red flares coming from behind the moon. We call these prominences. Now, at the time in 1860s, people didn't really understand where these red flames were coming from when totality happened. There was this guy named Joseph Norman Lockyer. He had an idea that maybe this is a part of the sun that you were witnessing, these flames. He had this idea, but didn't have the funds to go witness a total solar eclipse. So he came up with this idea, but there was a guy who actually did have the funds. His name was Pierre Janssen. He actually took the spectroscopy, the study of light coming from those flames, and realized it was part of the sun. It was the lower atmosphere of the sun. It was a very colorful sphere. Joseph Norman Lockyer also came to this conclusion that there is a colorful sphere going around the sun. So we named it the chromosphere, meaning colorful sphere. Joseph Norman Lockyer, he took it a little bit further and he kept studying the chromosphere after naming it. And he realized there was a new element that we could find on the sun by taking the spectroscopy of the sun. And this element was something that scientists on the Earth had not seen before. We named this element after the sun god Helios. This was the discovery of helium. So that discovery of helium was a pretty important one that we found through Total.
That is also amazing. I had no idea.
One thing that pops in my brain, Josh, is the current show that we're running in the Chaffron Planetarium called Meeting Totality. With our beautiful dome and our high-tech technology, we're able to take the audience and really create an immersive experience for them. And so for Meeting Totality, the big thing about this show is that we get to talk about how the moment of totality is so spectacular. And so we talk about a number of different environmental changes that you might experience, which we have touched on a bit here. And we also talk about other moments of totality in history where major scientific discoveries have been made. So this isn't just something to see and be in awe of. It also can help to progress forward different scientific concepts and discoveries.
We are discovering new mysteries, proving old theorems. So as a zoologist, to see an albino animal or an endangered animal, these are all of the most incredible things for me. But as an astronomer whose eyes are always up at the sky, I'm curious, what are you looking for in terms of something that would be an amazing find?
I think for me, and I also studied this when I was in college, is galaxy formation. So spectacular galaxies are filled with millions to billions of stars. Hmm. And specifically, I did research on active galactic nuclei. And that's a mouthful, so I just had the shorthand for AGN. So that's just a galaxy that has something very high-powered, very energetic at the center of galaxies outside of our own Milky Way. And so this is something in particular that I find interesting. I got to do a little bit of research on this particular subject in college. And so those are pretty interesting because there's still so much that we don't know about them. Right. I think those are the things that interest me the most about astronomy is that there's still so much that we don't know. And so anything like that, that piques my interest.
I have never heard of that, but I got to tell you, I also would like to see that active nuclei. That's amazing.
I think the one area that I've always been fascinated by, I think, is the stellar life cycle. So how stars form, how they change over time, and then all the real exciting stuff that happens when stars run out of fuel. They explode, can lead to the formation of black holes, and only one out of a few thousand stars that's massive enough to end its life in a supernova explosion. But I think if there was one thing I would love to observe up in the sky, I think it would be, you know, a supernova event taking place in our own galaxy. We believe that in a galaxy like the Milky Way, these happen, you know, once or twice a century, but there actually hasn't been one seen in the sky here in our own galaxy since, well, like the 1600s. So it's been centuries now. We're due for one. And I know there's always been speculation that maybe that one star Betelgeuse in Orion the Hunter might explode someday. And, you know, the time scales of these stellar lifetimes are so long that, you know, it's tough to predict something like that. But I think, you know, seeing something like that when they happen in our own galaxy, sometimes they're so brilliant they can be visible in broad daylight for weeks or even months, and then they fade away. You know, the ancient Chinese would call these guest stars because they pop up out of the blue and then gradually fade away. And I think seeing something like that would be mind-blowing. But I think the other cool thing there is here at the museum, we're always trying to make things relevant. You know, why does this matter? And I think you look up in the night sky, you see all these distant stars. You know, they're so far away. What does that have to do with us? Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing here is that the elements that make up our human bodies were forged inside the cores of massive stars. So we are stardust. And I think that's
stardust.
I think that was one of the things that hooked me early on. Was really getting an understanding of just how connected we are to the night sky. So there will be a brand new gallery. It'll be touching on a lot of different topics, everything from the scale of the universe to, you know, what we can learn by analyzing light from objects out in space. But one of my personal favorite things that I'm looking forward to is going to be this interactive exhibit. It's going to be called We Are Stardust, and it's going to give visitors control of the stellar life cycle. So you'll be able to create stars, carry them out on throughout their lives, trigger their death sequences. So I think that's going to be pretty cool.
We are truly stardust. I love that. We are actually truly stardust.
To everybody listening, as you might know, all the work done by the Cleveland Museum of Natural History is made possible through the generosity of people like you. If you would like to help us continue our work in scientific research, educating the public, and the conservation of natural areas over here in Northeast Ohio, please consider making a donation today. Simply go to give.cmnh.org. Fill in your information, and please be sure to mention our podcast in the comments. We would really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And speaking of the good work done by the Cleveland Museum of Natural History, we are currently going through a massive transformation project. The entire museum has been totally reimagined. If you haven't seen it, it is truly an architectural marvel. Destiny and Monica, do you guys have anything you want to add to kind of like this huge change that's coming into your well-established department?
I feel like this touches on this focus shift where it's more learner-centered. And so having a little bit more agency with that, something in particular might grab their attention. They might gravitate to it and interact with that exhibit that Nick touched on, We Are Stardust.
Yes.
Just to add on what Destiny said, this new way of interacting with science and the arts and just our collections in general is going to be a really good eye-opener to how we learn and also how we get curious about our natural world too.
So just this past fall, the museum opened up its brand new visitor hall, which is a free space for the public. It has 8 of the museum's most iconic specimens. And we love all of them, but for us here in the astronomy team, we are a little partial to one in particular, and that is our Apollo 12 moon rock. It's not every day that you get to look right up close at a true specimen that was brought back by the Apollo astronauts. And it's about a half-pound chunk of basalt on long-term loan from NASA. You know, with the eclipse coming up, the sun and moon have been hot topics for us in astronomy. And, you know, it's great to explore these worlds there in the planetarium and then go encourage, you know, visitors to just go right outside the door and, you know, you'll be able to see an actual chunk of the moon.
To really drive it home, you at any point for free can come to the Cleveland Museum of Natural History and see this moon rock taken on the Apollo 12 mission. And I'm trying to remember just how rare this small piece of the moon is.
Yeah, I want to say they brought back about 75 pounds of rocks.
Do you think you could pick that rock out of a lineup? I don't think I could. When I look at it, it looks like something that I could find on a hike. Do you have a different opinion on that?
The thing about that is a lot of the rock that we do have from the moon are types of rock we find here on Earth. So it might be a little tricky to pick it out in a lineup. As you say, I don't think I'd be able to do it. But it's a piece of basalt, which is a type of igneous rock that we have here on Earth as well.
It's not going to look or be made of a much different material than the stuff that we can find here. The incredible bit, I suppose, is the history that brought it here. This was the Apollo 12 mission, and that was the second mission to the moon.
Everybody knows Neil Armstrong's famous first words when he set foot onto the moon with Apollo 11. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Well, Pete Conrad, who was the commander of Apollo 12, he was a bit on the shorter side when it came to all the Apollo astronauts. And so his first words when he set onto the lunar surface was, "Whoopee, that may have been a small one for Neil, but that's a big one for me."
So here they go up. They have the second moon landing ever. What did you say that astronaut's name was?
That was Pete Conrad.
Pete Conrad.
So we only ever see one side of the moon. We call it the near side. There is a far side of the moon, and the only way you're going to see that is if you travel aboard a spaceship, like those astronauts on Apollo 12. So during a new moon, the near side of the moon is not illuminated by the sun. Remember, a solar eclipse can only occur during a new moon. But during new moons, the far side of the moon is fully illuminated by the sun there.
Yeah, so you could think about the dark side or the far side of the moon as being dark and that it's mysterious because we can't see it from our vantage point here on the Earth. But then all parts of the moon there, minus some permanently shadowed craters down at the poles, will receive sunlight there. So during a full moon, we're seeing the near side of the moon fully illuminated by the sun. During a new moon, it's the opposite. The far side that we don't see is lit up. And then a lot of times we're only seeing part of the illuminated half.
What should our listeners do in order to experience this eclipse to the fullest?
That's a great question, Josh. Mostly we recommend that people stay present, right? Because just like Nick mentioned, totality only lasts for a few minutes. So you want to make sure you get the most out of it. And so if you do have any equipment that you're planning to use to capture pictures or video, that's great as well, but you want to make sure that you also enjoy totality. So you don't really want to fumble with your tech too much. You don't want to miss those 4 minutes. Yeah. And for the moments before and after totality, you have to protect your eyes. So this is where you would use a pair of solar eclipse glasses. We have some here at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History gift shop.
I'm actually holding a pair. They're those classic paper little glasses, right, that you wear to watch your 3D movies jump out of the screen. The only difference is they have this mylar going over the lens, almost like regular sunglasses. Only these are completely blocking the light.
Mylar is a great type of material that can help to protect your eyes from the sun's light.
I think for me, the favorite viewing method is always going to be the welder's glass. I wear glasses myself, so the cardboard glasses are a little awkward. So I love the welder's glass. It's just going to be a dark enough shade. So shade number 14 is always the one that we recommend here at the museum. And the cool thing is that you can pick up like a plastic welding mask. You can find them online, very inexpensive. And it's a nice, really comfortable way of viewing the eclipse. That's what I used in 2017 during the partial stages. And this time, maybe I'll go all out and get a full mask that slides on.
And you can also do some indirect viewing methods. So these are pretty cool. You don't even have to look at the sun. So facing away from the sun, you can actually play with the shadows that are created during the partial phases of the eclipse. But you can use things like a colander, that bowl that drains all the water out of your pasta, to project the little crescents on the ground as you have those partial phases of the solar eclipse. You can also do that with other things that have openings, like if you interlaced your fingers, and if there's no solar eclipse happening, you would just see the front face of the sun, the solar disk. You see a round circle. But because you got the moon that's kind of eating the sun, it'll be this little crescent of the sun blocked out as the moon is moving in front of it. You can make a pinhole viewer, which is pretty cool. Again, another indirect method. And you don't even have to look at the sun. So a lot of creativity.
Yes. And Destiny, this is reminding me, I've seen somebody filming a forest when this happens, right? Because in a forest, little leaves make perfect circles of sunshine that hit the forest floor. But during an eclipse, those perfect circles are formed into crescents.
I found myself in trouble in 2017 because we were at that drive-in theater and there wasn't a whole lot of tree cover, but we kind of snuck away from the group. A few of us did. We went out onto the outskirts and did manage to find a few trees. So we were mesmerized seeing all these little projected images of the sun dappling the ground, and really cool to see them as those branches are kind of swaying and blowing around in the trees. But we were pushing it there. We got a little too close to the start of totality, and we were getting yelled at by the rest of the group to head back.
Get moving. Yeah. Yeah, if you only have 4 minutes.
This is something that comes around not very often. So wanting to capture it on your phone or something like that, don't waste your time. You can use something like a tripod. I would recommend maybe even taking a video. You can take still images from that video, plus you'll get the bonus of audio with the eclipse. So set up your phone and let your phone just do its thing while you're taking in the moment. And then once the moment's over and you're done observing, you can go back to your phone and you can watch it all over again.
Make sure you charge your phones, charge your cameras, bring spare battery packs for when you might run out of battery. I thought about that. My phone always, the battery always goes out when I don't want it to. So make sure you keep those devices charged as well. Make sure you put gas in your car. Bring snacks. Be prepared.
If somebody listening to this podcast says, I want to do what they do, tell them a little bit about what they would expect if they got into a career to become an astronomer.
First thing, you're always looking up into the sky. It's always changing. You'll see different star patterns in the sky.
throughout the seasons. You'll see different planets in the sky. So, well, different things that you'll be able to witness, but that's where we get most of our information from, is observing.
Yeah, I think I might add on to that. We do get to look up at the sky a lot, like Monica just mentioned. And then depending on what you might want to do with that, say if you want to look up at the sky and share with an audience what you see, you could do a lot of outreach like we do here at the museum, and also a lot of public shows. So we get to engage with the audience quite a bit and do a lot of science communication. But you could also do a little bit of scientific research as well. So you could look up at the sky, use a telescope, and use your findings to, say, discover something new.
On today's episode, we talked about eclipses with our incredible astronomy team, Nick Anderson, Monica Marshall, and Destiny Thomas. I hope you can appreciate just how lucky we are for this total solar eclipse to be arriving here in Cleveland on April 8th, 2024. We won't see anything like this again for over 400 years. I'm your host, Josh Avsek, and this has been the Cleveland Podcast of Natural History. This has been an original production by the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. This episode was produced by Chris Gellis and associate producer Kem Jacob. A special thanks to our senior team, led by CEO Sonia Winner, for all their support and cooperation in making this podcast possible. I hope to see you all soon. Stay curious, my friends.